The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, two of Britain's most celebrated scientists shoot the breeze on Precambrian creatures, neotenous sea squirts, and the larynxes of operatic sopranos. Yes, who else could make all that interesting but Richard Dawkins and David Attenborough? Plus, hot-footing it from Cambridge by the power of plants, Alison Smith reveals the secrets of harnessing green energy from algae. And is the government on the verge of slashing funding for science? This is an especially herbivorous edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello everyone, welcome back. A big welcome to Alison Smith, a professor at the Department of Plant Sciences at Cambridge University. Alison, welcome to the podcast. You've brought two they're not test tubes, are they? They're sort of containers. I know that Ian, our producer, said to you, bring some props, but this is quite interesting. What's in them?
Yes, well, they're two little flasks containing two different species of algae. One of the things about algae that I'm particularly keen to get everybody to know about is how different they are, how diverse they are. And one of the simplest ways of illustrating that is their different colours. So this one here that I'm picking up now is full of green algae. These are microscopic creatures, so you can't actually see anything. It's just
a green fluid.
And then the other one is brown algae, and they are completely different. They're completely unrelated to one another. They're more different than we are, say, from fruit flies, but they do interesting things.
Which we're going to talk about in just a moment. And to help us talk about some of this stuff is The Guardian's Troublesome Twosome, Ian Sample and James Randerson. Welcome back, gents.
Hello. Hello.
We're going to start by asking, part of the research that you're doing is about energy and making algae work for us, essentially. How can they give us sources of fuel or energy that we can use in the future that is as low carbon as possible? It's something that's very close to all of our hearts here at The Guardian. So let's go right back to the beginning. Algae are essentially very, very sort of basic plants that can do all sorts of things, and there's millions of species.
Not millions of species, about 300,000,
right,
but that's still quite a lot. They photosynthesize, that's the principal attraction of them and why they can be low carbon. So in other words, they take light energy and they use that to fix carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and turn it into more of themselves. And then you can use the algal cells, the so-called biomass, to produce energy. So you could just use it exactly as we would do with wood. You could just burn it.
I mean, usually people might have sort of come across algae as an annoyance in ponds and rivers and that kind of place. You want to get rid of this stuff. Why do you want to grow more of it?
That's the problem with sort of saying algae is something. It's not just one type of organism, and you can use it for different things. It's rather annoying to have Japanese knotweed in your garden, but that doesn't mean to say that we think wheat is a bad idea. So by growing algae in industrial settings, you could optimise their growth, produce large amounts of it, and then because they produce chemicals that could be used as fuel molecules directly, you might be able to produce diesel, for example, from algae. That's the low-carbon solution. So they fix CO2, make oil, and then you use the oil in your vehicles.
And so this is the $64 million question, isn't it? So if we can harness enough oil or some other hydrocarbon from the products of algae, we could use that as a way of powering cars and doing all sorts of other things without having to dig up oil from the ground, or when the oil runs out from the ground,
this is another
source. So what are the steps that we need to take before that's going to be possible? I mean, could you right now take a usable oil from a batch of a particular type of algae?
Yep, you can do that. You can actually buy a book on the internet, How to Make Algal Biodiesel at Home in Your Garage. The problem is that you can't make very much of it at the moment because there's no infrastructure for growing large amounts of algae as there is for growing large amounts of crop plants. In addition, the amount of energy that you need to put in to grow them efficiently and then also to extract the oil at the moment is not optimised. And so it's marginal about whether you would actually get more energy out than you would put in.
And so the question is scaling up.
Yeah.
And what about the actual discovery of different interesting, you know, species? Can you just find useful species out in the wild, or do you have to modify them in some way?
Well, as I said at the beginning, there are many, many different types of algae, and we really only know about a few in detail at the moment. So there is an opportunity for bioprospecting. But in some ways, maybe it's better to try and manipulate the ones that we have at the moment. And you can do that by growing them in different ways and then optimizing the growth. Then the knowledge you get from that might then enable you to be more effective in growing them or in growing new species that you find as they come along.
There's a huge amount of hype at the moment about synthetic biology, about sort of Craig Venter creating new forms of life with synthetic genomes in order to do useful things. But it's always struck me that, you know, that's a very kind of cumbersome way. I mean, you know, a scientific tour de force, but a kind of cumbersome way to get to what we want to get to. If what we want to do is find a new way of creating, of producing energy in a more sustainable way, you know, the algae are sort of part of the way there to doing it in a useful way for us. Mm. I mean, does synthetic biology offer anything more, do you think, than the sort of research you're doing here?
Well, I think there are two aspects of this. Firstly, there is what you do with the algae. And so you could use the algal cells, as I said, simply as a source of fuel. In that case, probably synthetic biology is not necessarily essential. However, other uses for algae is as a sort of industrial microbiology platform, making bulk chemicals or high-value products, which actually many of those are made from fossil fuels at the moment. And so if you could substitute using the fossil fuels for those, then you could use that for some other use. The thing with synthetic biology is that it's in its infancy, but it applies the principles of engineering to primary production, which hasn't really been done a great deal before. And I think it's a really innovative and important approach which should be explored, but probably in the short term, say in the next sort of 5 years or so, we're going to be able to generate energy from algae in a much simpler way.
One of the other advantages of using algae, for example, as opposed to something like your traditional biofuels, is that you don't have to compete for space when growing the sort of the substance itself. So if you're growing corn to make into ethanol, it can push out food crops, whereas algae, I'm led to believe, you can grow in deserts if you wanted to, if you had the special bioreactors and things. On that front of going into interesting areas, going into interesting places, how far are we along in actually making this real? Because in labs you can do it, as you say, we've got some here in the studio now. How far are we from actually seeing algae fuel in our petrol tanks?
Well, there are commercial operations to generate algal biomass, but usually that's for high-value products. They're a sort of niche market, if you like. And they're grown in basically open ponds in hot, dry places. One of the reasons for doing that is because that reduces contamination, because they grow in very specialist conditions, for example, very high salt conditions. So you don't get contamination by other organisms, which can be a problem in open systems. So it's not impossible to imagine doing this sort of thing, to grow it for fuel. It's just the scale at which you do it. So in order to make a difference, to produce enough fuel, you have to do it on a very large area. And that basically has not been done. However, there are pilot plants which are starting in Australia, in Israel, in America. And it's not impossible to imagine, probably in the next 5 years, that it will be available. Fuel from algae will be available.
Ian, why don't you give us your algae question?
Well, I was just quite interested in what the kinds of other things are that you can do with algae other than trying to look at energy issues.
Well, there are lots of possible uses for algae. One of the things which I'm particularly interested in is in remediation. Algae photosynthesize, as I've said, and they take CO2 out of the atmosphere, but they actually do it much more efficiently if they're provided with CO2, extra CO2, not just using the ambient levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so you can couple their growth to flue gases, for example, from fixed installations, from a power station even, or even your household boiler. And then you can take some of the CO2 out of the atmosphere, produce the biomass, and then in a so-called virtuous cycle, you can use the biomass to provide the fuel to run the boiler.
What about other molecules? I mean, if you can do hydrocarbons for fuel, you could do other interesting drugs, maybe?
Yeah, well, as I said, they already now grow algae for some high-value compounds such as food colorants, vitamins, and also fish food. So certain stages in fish farms, you actually need to supply algae. But in addition, there is the opportunity to get them to make things of use. So again, in the industrial microbiology platform, there are people who are interested in trying to generate proteins in them, vaccines, for example. and also for producing unsaturated fatty acids, omega-3 oils and so on. In fact, that's where you get the omega-3 oils from. The fish eat the algae, which make the precursors to that.
OK, Alison, we'll leave that there, but do stay with us as we look at what's been in the news this week.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
We've all brought a story with us. Let's start with James Randerson. This is about the BP oil spill.
Well, last week, BP came out with its report into what happened and some of the aftermath of the oil spill and the explosion on the rig that killed 11 people and injured 17. And, you know, it really paints quite a vivid picture of what happened, you know, explains the sort of sequence of events and how it all came to pass. Amazing sort of catalogue of failures, 8 separate incidents and safety devices that failed, or people who responded to signals incorrectly, things like anomalous pressure readings when the oil had already broken through a concrete seal and started coming up the pipe towards the rig, and rather than shutting down the pipe at that point, they kept it going. Basically, they sort of, for some reason, they decided those anomalies weren't bad enough to act on. When the oil reached the rig, instead of realizing that it was, you know, the pressure was rising and venting the oil off the rig, it ended up kind of erupting onto the rig initially as mud. And then when that happened, they shut down a valve, which meant that it went through a kind of gas and liquid separator. So you had, you know, all this gas venting onto the rig. That gas escaped from an area where it was designed to be spark-free into another area where there were sparks, and that eventually led to these two massive explosions. And at that point, it was impossible, presumably because of the explosions having destroyed a bunch of the kit, they weren't able to manually shut down. I mean, presumably the people on the rig had other worries at this point, but it wasn't possible to manually shut down the blowout preventer. But the blowout preventer down in the depths should have shut off automatically. There were automatic systems that sort of say, if there's a power failure on the rig, then shut this thing down. But unfortunately, in one of them, the batteries in a control pod were flat, and in the other one, the critical valve was faulty. So all of these things went wrong, and if one of them had gone right, then the oil spill wouldn't have happened in the way it did. There's a huge amount of spin that's gone into this report, and what BP are really trying to do is spread the blame here. They're saying, you know, we will take our fair share of the blame, and frankly, they can't avoid that. It'd be ridiculous if they tried.
The subcontractors.
Exactly. They're trying to spread it around as much as they can to Transocean, who were operating the rig, and Halliburton, who made the concrete that was part of the story that I mentioned earlier on. So, yeah, they're trying to spread the blame.
Well, Tony Hayward, who, well, until recently was BP's chief exec, did say it was just a bad cement job that caused the thing. I mean, in one of his many infamous PR gaffes, that was his explanation for the whole thing. And you say Halliburton did that.
Can I ask, one of the things that people have been talking about a great deal about this disaster was that, you know, this is really difficult oil exploration. Does the report suggest that these sort of problems would have happened whatever the depth at which the oil rig was at, or is it specific to this very deep type of drill?
I think that a lot of the problems are not specific to the depth, but that was certainly a factor that made things a lot more difficult. So partly, yes.
What seems particularly shocking about this is that if you look at a lot of engineering going on these days, that some people in risk analysis are saying that things are getting so complicated that it's actually impossible to work out all of the routes by which something might fail because there's just so many different permutations. What's shocking about this one is that the failure mechanism, the route of failure, was not unsurprising, but every fail-safe they had in place didn't work. And that's
there's supposed to be redundancy, isn't there?
But you're supposed to identify your failure modes and then put redundancies in to stop it at all different chains down the line, so that at the end of the day you can't have, you know, if one thing fails, another thing backs it up. And obviously you need to know how something might go wrong to be able to put those in place. But in this, they knew what could go wrong and they put the things in place, but they just didn't work. And that's really shocking.
You know who has written about this in a very interesting way is Malcolm Gladwell. In his book Outliers, there's a whole chapter about how Chernobyl happened. And it was exactly like this, where there's about 8 fail-safes that didn't work. And there were very, very simple ways that didn't work. Like, for example, the light was one. There was some light that was flashing on the control board in the control room, which happened to be covered by a label that had been stuck to a light above, to a sort of switch above it that had been repaired that morning, and so on. So all sorts of things like this, just little things. And he says that big disaster, his conclusion was the big disasters don't happen because because engineering is bad. It's because it's a collection of very, very small errors that happen. And I guess the other way of putting it in, what you're saying, is that there's probably lots of drills where this stuff doesn't happen because the fail-safes do work. So this is an outlier, essentially, but it's worth learning from. Let's move on to something that's going to strike much closer to home here in Britain. Vince Cable, the business secretary, gave a speech last week on the future of science in...
Well, that's right. I mean, this was Vince Cable's first science speech. And we know that next month we'll be hearing what the sort of cuts are going to be, particularly for science and research. And this has sparked a huge fuss, as it would do. I mean, you have a very nervous community of scientists in this country at the moment, I think it's fair to say. His speech said a couple of very key things that I've pulled out, and that was that we need to screen out mediocrity and we need to do more with less. And I think a lot of people find that if you have less, you tend to do less. But what really, I think, caused some of the problem was in a follow-up interview on one of the BBC radio programmes in this country, he said that 45% of research is not of an excellent standard and we have to raise the bar. This really put the cat among the pigeons in this country, really, because his figure was taken from something called the research assessment exercise, which really looks at outputs of research, quality of papers published and such like. And it was said, that report from 2008 said that 54% is world leading and internationally excellent, thereby another 46% was not of that standard according to this research assessment exercise. The strange thing that's happened here is this is a mangling of figures and a misuse of metrics, essentially. This 54% of world-leading or internationally excellent research in this country absorbs about 90% of our science funding. So essentially these are wrong figures, and they're actually, I think, dangerously misleading, because if the government is going to make cuts to science based on figures it doesn't understand, we are not going to get a good outcome.
Just a quote from Vince Cable's speech. He said that you can't justify spending taxpayer money on research that is neither commercially useful nor theoretically outstanding. And it's all part of the UK's austerity drive, where government departments across the board have been asked to look for 25% cuts. Some places have been ring-fenced and protected. The National Health Service, for example, is one of those, which means that other departments, other sections, and science comes under the business department, may get more than 25% cuts, hefty cuts to a base which is already not funded to the level it is in other countries. Alison, you're right at the forefront of this, applying for grants, being rated by the research assessment exercise. Vince Cable's speech is an indicator of what might happen. Is science something you can just cut and then refund in 2 years, like every other department?
Well, I think I should start by admitting that there will never be enough science funding, however much money there is. But just to give you a little anecdote from my own research area, until, say, 2 or 3 years ago, most people thought like you did, which was that algae are a nuisance. They're slime on your ponds or on your patios. You know, it's basically been a completely sort of ignored area of science, but a few of us have been soldiering on doing this because we're interested in it. Effectively, blue skies research until very recently. And now suddenly we're at the forefront of all of the things that I was talking to you about before.
And what's something that Craig Venter calls the trillion-dollar organism, perhaps.
Exactly.
Which could be the organism that produces the fuel of the future.
Exactly. And it's not possible to predict what will be useful in the future, not even 5 years, let alone 30 years.
James?
At the risk of boring everyone with figures, I just want to pick up slightly on what Ian was outlining from the figures. And this 54%, as you said, you know, implies that the other 46% is pretty rubbish, but actually that's not the case, because that includes the 1 and 2 star figures, and 33% are rated 2 star, and that is research that's recognised internationally for its originality, significance and rigour. So it's not like the rest of it is not very good. And as Ian says, the highest brackets swallow up most of the money anyway, so even if you said, right, we're going to leave out all the other stuff, you wouldn't save as much money as you might think. I just wanted to ask a sort of devil's advocate question, though, to Alison, and that is, you know, at a time when almost all of government spending is being cut to the tune of 25%+, apart from, as Alex said, some ring-fenced areas, why should science be immune to that?
I think it's not reasonable for it to be immune to it at all. I think perhaps the need to reduce the amount of spending is perfectly reasonable. It's just the basis on which you do that, I think, has got to be correct. So I think, as Ian pointed out, it's inappropriate to say the reason that we're cutting it, or the reason it's easy to cut it, is that, you know, a lot of it is mediocre. That's incorrect. And instead, I guess you have to take a punt. You have to say, you know, for the time being, we can't do everything, and take a view across the board. But I don't think you can do that very easily. One of the things that the UK is particularly strong in my own areas, is sort of biosciences. And so maybe that's an appropriate area to support. On the other hand, it could be that, you know, the algae don't provide all of the solutions, and you need to have some engineering solutions and so on. And so I think it's a very difficult question. It's just really important not to do it on the basis of false figures.
Okay, well, let's move on from that very serious issue to something even more serious. Alison, what's your story?
Well, just as a juxtaposition to what we were talking about before, a very important study that caught my eye was this thing about men and dancing. I think it's sort of guaranteed to make all men refuse to dance, which is not what women want. But this is a study where the researchers videoed men, I think in Jamaica, dancing, and then they used avatars to mimic the dancing, and then they showed it to men and women and asked them to rate whether they were good or not. And interestingly, men generally weren't considered to be particularly good dancers, in particular the ones that wave their arms around.
Like they just don't care. No one would write this story for a newspaper, would they? I mean, it just seems ridiculous. It seems ridiculous to have a video of it on your website, guardian.co.uk/science.
And nobody would watch it either.
What does it say, Ian, about the fact that this was the most popular story on our website last week?
You know, someone asked this question. Is it demeaning and a really bad idea for the media to be running, you know, let's call it a silly story? And you know, science stories often play that role. I mean, you know, your science story will sit among bombs in Iraq and horrendous things happening at home to lighten a newspaper's coverage. And I don't know, my own feeling is that I'm not particularly comfortable with it, but I think you should run them, because there may not be an awful lot of science in that particular story, but it's fun and it's entertaining. And I don't think that necessarily needs to be bad. And I think sometimes, as scientists, we can get, or former scientists, we can get a little sensitive about science being used as in an entertaining way.
Alison, as an actual scientist, you're not sensitive about this story, are you?
Not at all. And I think one of the things which is really important is to try and identify features of interactions between organisms, and the work that these people are doing is relevant to animal behaviour and understanding how this sort of thing evolved. So I don't think it's not science. I think perhaps it's the fact that, you know, there are all these closet dancers or John Travolta's out there who are trying to get clues to work out the best way of dancing. Maybe that's the spin that journalists put on it.
Well, I was going to say, the reading I took of it was basically, if you want to be seen as a good dancer, you have to move your hips around a lot.
Absolutely.
And if you just move your arms around, then it's not so good. But if you look at the videos, I mean, honestly, the good dancer, quotes, was awful. I mean, it looked like
Mind you, the other one was rubbish.
But at least a bit understated. A bit sort of like, just, I don't know how to dance, but I'm not going to make a fool of myself.
Which one, you know, are you closest to in your dancing
style? I have an eclectic style.
You're just uncategorizable.
Undefinable. Anyway, if you want to see that video, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. It's still up there and probably will be for a while. And for information on all the other stuff, you can go to the same website or environmentguardian.co.uk. And finally, what better way to end the show than with two of the finest thinkers and broadcasters on the planet? The Guardian's Weekend magazine brought together David Attenborough and Richard Dawkins for a chat about some of the things they find most exciting, a discussion of some of the questions they still wonder about in their years of scientific experience. You can imagine it made for quite a fascinating conversation. They started off considering the problem that they hope scientists will have solved by the end of this century.
The production of energy without any deleterious effects on the environment.
Oh, that would be marvellous. That really would be marvellous.
The problem is that then you'd be so powerful that there'd be no restraint at all on humanity and you'd continue wrecking everything.
Fascinating point. Yes, that's right. I was thinking more academically of the problem of human consciousness and what that is and how nervous systems, how brains give rise to this extraordinary
The other thing that we're on the verge of is a desalination process which would not be too energy demanding. And since the places that need desalination are nearly always in the tropics where they're deserts, or very considerably anyway, there is a lot of sunshine around there. And if you can really harness solar energy to produce desalination, you could make the Sahara bloom.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yes. Mm. But I know you're working on a new project with Cambrian and Precambrian. When's that coming out?
It comes out at the end of this year. It's one of the I reckon we are living in the most exciting intellectual time in history. In my lifetime, we have discovered such profundity, such huge principles. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, I went to the professor of geology at Cambridge and said, wouldn't you talk to us about the way that continents are drifting? And he said, when anybody can demonstrate to me, my dear Attenborough, that the continents move by a millimetre, I will consider it. But until then, it's sheer moonshine, dear boy. And of course, within 5 years of me leaving Cambridge, it was proved. And suddenly, all the problems disappeared. I mean, the problem of why Australia animals were different. And the absolutely bonkers explanations which we were told about how they migrated down the island chain from the northern hemisphere, but somehow or other there was a different way of reproducing which they acquired before or after, which was complete nonsense. So we were supposed to accept this. But that one thing in itself has totally changed our understanding and made sense of everything. And the big thing that I made 30 years ago, I made a series called Life on Earth. We had to start with really complex organisms, really, because before then there was no evidence as to how they were. There were stromatolites, and you knew that. But the ecology of the very first oceans was not known. And since that time, in the last 100 years, we have discovered so much. And one of the really rivetingly interesting things is that there is one particular kind of fossil from the Precambrian, part of the geological column, which until quite recently was thought to be without any fossils of any kind. And these are animals that are fractal. Fractal animals mean that, well, you probably know, but it means that they have a little process in which they grow and branch. And that is then replicated again and again and again and again and again of branching. And it's like crystals of ice on your window pane. That little element repeats itself, but it then makes it repeat on a bigger dimension, a bigger dimension, a bigger dimension. And that's what the very early multicellular animals were like. And it was a dead end. It didn't work. Because if you have that method of growing, you can't develop a gut. You can't develop anything different. All you can do is that. And so you can absorb nutrients from the sea, but that's all you can do. And that took that to quite a large limit. I mean, some of these things are 2 feet long, you know, but they're fractal. And just sitting there, looking at the deposits, looking at the fossils, these a great landscape of fractal fossils, you know. I mean, that's thrilling.
It's an interesting idea that a group of animals could get locked into a
That's
particular
right.
way and then somehow can't back out again.
That's right.
In a way, that might tie into larval forms. Alistair Hardy long ago suggested that using the larva as a way of, he called it the escape from specialisation, that if the adult form is stuck in a rut, as it might be fractal or some other kind of rut, then new evolution can take place by going to the larva and branching off
neotenous adults like us. I mean, we're not neotenous apes, aren't we?
And vertebrates may be neotenous sea squirts.
I hadn't thought of that. I'll have to ponder on that. That'll be something that will distract me.
I think they're the ones, aren't they, that they're said to eat their brain. When that's the joke about when you get tenure, you settle down and eat your brain. Do you think that as evolution goes by, I mean, as you imagine yourself back in the Cambrian, I think a lot of people would assume, well, these are very old animals, they're right at the beginning of evolution, they probably weren't very good at what they did. And I suspect that may be wrong, actually, that they probably were.
I think what they were good at is over a wider scope of talent. I mean, they live in mud of all kinds, doesn't matter. Mm. But what's then going to happen is that some are going to live in deep mud, better at it than those who are living in just in mud, and some are going to live in and shallower mud, and so on. So it's rather unfair to say that just because you're good, you're a generalist living in mud in general, that that is less skillful than one that lives in shallow mud. It's just that you've been ousted in the competition, that you, if you're a generalist. And that's why when you get living fossils like horseshoe crab or something, which occur in the Cambrian, why are they still there? Because there is one particular aspect of life which they started off as being wonderful generalists, and then other things came in and occupied specialist positions across this spectrum of things. Just one that was left that was nothing else had yet specialised in it, and that's why Limulus has remained.
Yes, yes, that's nice. But there's no general reason to think that just because the Cambrian's a long time ago, that Cambrian animals were in general less good at it.
No. Then they were jolly good.
It probably is true that there is a progressive element in evolution in the short term. If you say, well, obviously eyes, once they become proper camera eyes with lenses and things, are better than they were when they started, there has to be an improvement. But that probably only takes a few million years to get that sort of improvement. And so it probably is true that when a lineage branches out into a new way of life, it then gets better for about 5 million years, but not 500 million years. You wouldn't see progressive improvement over that sort of timescale.
One of the things that entertains me is when I listen to a soprano singing a Handel aria with an astonishing coloratura and so on, you know, from this particular larynx, I say to myself, there has to be a biological reason why that was useful at some stage. The larynx of a human being did not evolve without having some function. And the only function I can see is that it's a sexual attraction, really. But it's a nice notion that in fact, when you listen to the spider, it isn't training. I mean, you had to have actually the raw instrument with which you can refine, but you've got to get the instrument first. And the instrument only comes in response to a demand.
Sexual selection, I think, is very important and is probably underrated. I mean, Darwin, Wallace was not very keen on sexual selection. And I think Darwin has pretty much been vindicated. And I think very often the idea that much of what's special about humans, as Darwin said, it may well be.
Yeah, but what I like to do, what I like to think, is that if I think a male bird of paradise is beautiful, my appreciation of it is precisely the same thing as a female.
Absolutely. Yes, I love that thought.
I think that's lovely. Yes. I enjoy that.
I enjoy that too. And when you think of, I mean, Keats's Ode to a Nightingale, my heart aches, that a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. What is it, 1 minute past and Leithiwoods had sung. Keats was drugged by the nightingale song, and so are other nightingales.
Okay.
It's the same effect. It's that the nightingale song has been naturally selected to have a drugging effect on rival nightingales and on female nightingales. And incidentally, it happens to have the same effect on us, and similarly, beautiful scents of flowers, and some flowers smell extremely ugly to us. We don't empathise in the same way. If you look at the development of birdsong in the developing young male, in many species, they're trial and error. They're trying it out on themselves. So when a male bird develops his song, practising, trying it out, he's testing it on a brain of his own species. It happens to be his own brain. So when he listens to say, what turns me on? If a young male nightingale perfecting his song is drugging himself, and but what also drugs himself will work on a female.
But he also has to crib the raw material, doesn't he? He has to have examples.
In some species, no doubt.
Because if you rear them without hearing anybody else but yourself,
yes,
they don't get very good.
Yes.
They're just a very basic twitter.
But in some cases, the one that they need to have heard, they only need to have heard him early in life.
Yes.
And they take a sort of tape recording.
Yes, sir.
And then they practice on themselves, listening to make sure that it sounds the way they remember in those species that do that. But my point is that they're using themselves as a model of the female that they're trying to impress. If it impresses me, it'll probably impress her. And of course, I'm not suggesting they think that out. But
Alison, how does it feel solving the problems that David Attenborough thinks are the most important? Because you're doing that.
Well, I'm contributing towards it. I hope that I will be able to fulfil his dream. David Attenborough is a great hero of mine.
What a voice.
Absolutely. But you note they were talking about at the end about bird song, which is similar to dancing. So.
Awesome. That's a nicely tied up package there. Well, that's it from us this week. Thanks to Professor Alison Smith of Cambridge University, and also to Ian Sample and James Randerson. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And remember to have a look at our new science blogs too. You'll see posts there on genetic determinism, slime molds, psychedelic drugs, and also a smattering of science politics. guardian.co.uk/scienceblogs. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.